According to the Coalition for the Homeless, 52,400 homeless men, women, and children rely on the New York City Municipal Shelter System for a bed each night. That leaves more than 5,000 people, including many children, to find some other form of shelter or to spend the night on the streets. These numbers are higher than they've been in decades. In fact, since 2002, the number of homeless in shelters has risen by more than 69%. Ian Frazier, a staff writer for The New Yorker, wrote about the problem in an article called Hidden City, which was published in the October 28th issue of The New Yorker. He and Mary Bresnahan, president and CEO of the Coalition for the Homeless, joined us last month to talk about why there are so many homeless people in New York and what the city's new mayor, Bill de Blasio, should do about it. It was a powerful conversation that we are re-airing for you today. And I began by noting that in his article, Ian Frazier points out that most people don't realize that there are more homeless people in New York than any time since the Great Depression. And I asked him, why isn't it more obvious? Because we don't see as many people sleeping in cardboard boxes on the street?
Yes, basically. I mean, that's part of it. Also, the real growth in homelessness, or a very important part of it, has been growth of a number of homeless families. And families are generally not on the street. You see them maybe on the subway, if you can possibly identify that a person with a lot of suitcases and backpacks on the kids' backs and headed up to 151st Street is probably a homeless person. But they tend to be much less visible than single adults who do end up often on the street.
So, Mary, why are there more homeless families and children than there were 12 years ago? Is it just a reflection of the poor economy, or have the policies of the Bloomberg administration over the past 12 years been a factor?
Well, the policies are definitely the main driving factor. Certainly the economic downturn in 2008 played a role. But before that, in 2005, Mayor Bloomberg had announced that he was going to reduce homelessness by two-thirds, and we thought that was terrific. But right on the heels of that announcement, he eliminated any priority for federal housing relief for homeless families, and then subsequently stopped the local subsidy program. And since there's no way out of the shelter system for these families, the numbers just continue to escalate exponentially.
Ian, what are some of the stories that people told you about how they became homeless?
Well, a number of people told me that they had lost housing subsidy, the Advantage housing subsidy, which was begun by the Bloomberg administration and then abruptly terminated when the state cut back budgetary expenses in 2011. So a lot of people had, you know, the state had been and the city had been paying part of their rent, and that was taken away, and they lost their apartments. I talked to people who had lost their jobs, people who had where they had worked had been wiped out by the hurricane, that they had been working at a dock and the hurricane had wiped out the dock, that kind of story. So there were a number of stories, but the one that did keep coming up was the loss of the Advantage subsidy.
And what's life like in a homeless shelter?
Well, I mean, I didn't go into a lot of homeless shelters.
Mary,
really.
You have.
We sure have. The Coalition is the court-appointed monitors for the single adult system. And, you know, although there are some good shelters that are run by nonprofits, the front end of that system remains very chaotic and crowded. And so that's why we continue to see mentally ill people, for instance, on the street. But for the families, they are often put in one shelter, then another, and for the kids, obviously, makes it that much more difficult to get to school and to stay up with their schooling.
Do they get much privacy?
Well, very little. The Coalition runs an after-school program in one of the city-run shelters and, you know, congregate bathroom facilities, and literally the mothers have to take the children to the restrooms, which are in terrible condition. So entire families living in a single room. You know, as Ian said at the beginning of the show, you by and large won't see families on the street. And he does such a brilliant job explaining this in his article about the right to shelter in New York. And that's what makes New York different than many of the other cities.
And we'll get to that in a moment. But Ian, I wanted to ask you about this woman you spent some time with, Christina, who had three teenage children and two young grandchildren with her. What were her circumstances? How did she wind up staying in a shelter?
Well, she had been a home health aide, and she told me that her two patients that she had been working with had died quite in close succession. And one of them had been a young child with AIDS, and she became very depressed by this and was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and was unable to continue to work. And it is common, or more common than you might think, for home health aides to become homeless. It's a very low-paying job, and there are no benefits. It's kind of a dead-end job in the sense that if you're working with a very ill person, that person dies, and then you're sort of looking for work again. So she had followed that pattern, and then she did have an apartment that was paid for by Advantage, and she lost the Advantage subsidy and then bounced around in shelters after that.
And when you first met her, she was waiting for the paperwork to come through saying that she was eligible to stay in that shelter.
Right.
How long do people generally have to wait for that? And what happened in her case?
I'm not too sure. I think she did end up back in that shelter. I lost touch with her after a few weeks. A lot of people that I talked to had cell phones and gave me cell phone numbers, but for the number to, it was very rare that the number continued to work for longer than, you know, a couple weeks. So when the article came out, the fact checker did talk to Christina, and I think she was back in that that shelter in the Bronx where I had seen her and where she had been trying to get the paperwork to allow her to stay. So she may have succeeded at that.
My guests are Ian Frazier of The New Yorker. His article, Hidden City, appeared in the October 28th issue of the magazine. Also with us is Mary Brosnahan, President and CEO of the Coalition for the Homeless. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Mary, can you talk about what's involved in that application and approval process?
Well, it's very arduous, and so typically the family, first of all the family members have to be present, and so over the course of days, kids are missing out on school. They may be given a 10-day placement during that application process, but if they're denied shelter, and those denials have skyrocketed, they have to present new evidence, and so...
What are the reasons for denial?
They'll just say that you have another place to go to, and so for years, the Legal Aid Society and Coalition have been pleading with the mayor, with Mayor Bloomberg's administration, please just send a worker with the family to this address that you say is available. And if it's safe and available, of course, we want them to go there. But time and time again, there's something else going on. Undocumented domestic violence, people that have told them explicitly, if you show up here again, I'm going to have you arrested. And so they wind up at the coalition's office, and we try then to piece together why that placement is non-existent or dangerous for them.
There's a new building, the PATH, which stands for Prevention, Assistance, and Temporary Housing, that's in the Bronx. Is it an improvement over what had been there before?
Well, the physical plant is an obvious improvement. We had, and also families were sleeping there on the floor. But what's not an improvement is now those families are getting on buses very late at night. The children are getting a few hours of sleep, and then they're back there the next day. So it's, you know, we welcome the cosmetic improvement, but the denial has just been stepped up repeatedly, and so we're seeing more and more families denied who literally have no place else to go.
Ian, can you explain the preventive assistance the city offers people who come to PATH?
Well, they do try and find other places for you to go to prevent you from being homeless. I went up there, I did a tour of it, and the people who worked there I thought were, you know, real sincere and dedicated, but the stories they told were of, you know, you asked the applicant where else, you know, in the world could this person be? You know, could, if you had a house or the possibility of a house anywhere else, they will try and get you to that house. And on some occasions, they'll just give you a plane ticket. And they told me the list of the places where they had sent people, you know, that where people had other possibilities of housing, and a lot were in the South or in Florida. A surprising number were in Alaska. I was amazed at that. They said, oh, yeah, we give a lot of tickets to people to go to Alaska. That's just, you know.
I don't know anybody who has a relative in Alaska.
I actually do know people in Alaska. So.
But path never closes. Is that important?
I think it's amazing. I mean, it, you know, it operated through the hurricane. It operated through, you know, just any kind of city shutdown or crisis. It keeps going. And to go up there as they did in the wee hours, you know, late at night and see it all lit up and, you know, people still, you know, pushing their strollers up the long ramp to the door and very late at night. And it's one of those kind of mythic New York City places that just, it truly never sleeps.
Well, it's the place of last resort.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mary, as we mentioned earlier, although many people probably don't know, a shelter for the homeless is actually a legal right.
Yeah.
In New York. Does any other city or state include the right to shelter in its constitution?
No, not like New York. And very interestingly, it was inserted, the clause in that state constitution that care and aid shall be provided to the needy came in the Constitutional Convention that followed the Great Depression. So people were on the heels of understanding what utter destitution means when there's no place to go. And then, obviously, the coalition was founded in bringing litigation so that people ought to have a decent place to go to.
Well, since it is law, how have recent mayors approached the right to shelter?
Well, I would have to say none with open arms.
Because it costs the city a lot of money?
It does. And, you know, I think one of the beauty of the arc of Ian's story is that he comes back to talking with Bob Hayes, the founder. And let me tell you, Ed Koch hated the coalition and the right to shelter more than probably any mayor. And but he was sort of pushed to the point where he had to make that massive commitment in permanent housing. And obviously, we're not in business to open more and more shelters. We want the city to invest in housing-based solutions. And we want to keep people alive until they can get into that housing.
But Ian, your article suggests that Ed Koch may have been better for the homeless than many.
Well, he did have to come up with some kind of plan for housing because the numbers were very high during his administration, and the Coalition for the Homeless had pressed him on it. And so he came up with, or continued actually, a plan and expanded it, the in-rem housing, which was a plan whereby he took the city took buildings that had been seized for tax delinquency and made them into housing for low-income people and homeless people. And when Koch died last February, I think it was, or January, but he died in 2013, and his obituaries, right at the top of the obituaries, it said, you know, Koch created housing for poor people. And it was like his legacy.
Despite his resistance initially.
Despite the fact it wasn't what he had wanted to do at all. But if that hadn't been part of his legacy, what would you have said about Koch? You know, he said, how am I doing? You know, I mean, it was the thing that gave him substance, finally. Although he was a colorful mayor and an interesting person, this was sort of substantial. And it shows, it's interesting that, you know, you can do all kinds of things, but what people will remember you for and have affection and even love for you for is when you help the helpless. I mean, what LaGuardia is remembered as the greatest mayor of all time, probably, and he was the one who pushed through the amendment to the state constitution on which the right to shelter is based.
And so, he was a Republican. But but Mary, what happened after Koch? Why are we no longer talking about in-rem?
Well, by and large, those buildings were snatched up, and a lot of them were made into permanent housing by homeless people, by homeless groups and affordable housing groups. But what has happened, you know, Dave Dinkins followed up on, you know, growing that housing supply. Rudolph Giuliani attacked the right to shelter head on and really just wanted to get rid of it. And so we ensued in, you know, sort of epic battles in court where he wanted to have the right to throw people out or prevent them from coming in. And, you know, we were so happy when Bloomberg came in. We thought that he would, you know, go back to what worked. But I think again and again they say we don't want to have an inducement for people to come into shelter.
Well, it's interesting that there was a lawsuit earlier in 1979, Callahan versus Carey, that tested the right to shelter. Mm-hmm. We'll come back to that after we take a little break. We are talking about the growing number of homeless in New York City, the worst since the Depression, as written about in a very powerful article by Ian Frazier in The New Yorker called Hidden City. It was in the October 28th issue. And Ian, we wanted to talk to you earlier, but you were out of the country. Now you're just out of New York State. So this is a little more convenient. He is with us along with Mary Brosnahan, President and CEO of the Coalition for the Homeless. Stay with us for more. We're back with a conversation I had last month with Mary Brosnahan, who's president and CEO of the Coalition for the Homeless, and Ian Frazier, whose article Hidden City, about the record-breaking numbers of homeless in New York City today, appeared in the October 28th issue of The New Yorker. It was a sobering conversation, and we are re-airing it for you today. I opened the second part of our conversation by noting that the right to shelter was tested in the courts in a 1979 case called Callahan versus Carey. And I asked Ian Frazier if he could tell us about it. Who was Callahan?
Well, Callahan was a kind of a fixture on the Bowery. He was a homeless man who had, I guess what you'd say, was some substance abuse problems. And Robert Hayes was a young attorney. He was 26 years old, and he was living in Washington Square Park. And he noticed that there were a lot of the numbers had gone way up. That was a time when suddenly homelessness was really growing in the city. And so he looked into the legal status of homeless people in the city and found that this amendment to the Constitution, the 17th Amendment, did call for the city to house and take care of its needy people. It just said it shall take care of these people, and he brought a class action lawsuit on behalf of Callahan and two other homeless men, and he brought it in October of 1979, and against everybody's expectation, he won the lawsuit.
Well, you would have thought that would have settled the situation. So what happened when Giuliani then challenged it? Wasn't there already a precedent?
Well, it was actually settled in a consent decree. The city lawyers realized that they were likely to fail. And so there was an agreement between the coalition, the city, and the state that, you know, we would provide shelter for men. And we used to say Ed Koch was so great, we sued again for women and then a third time for children. We don't really say that as much anymore. But in the process of that, yeah, there was a precedent. But Giuliani looked into other consent decrees, like, for instance, you know, how inmates were being boarded, you know, tripled and up and so on, and how consent decrees in other states were being reopened. And he used that as a way to try to get back in there and say, no, there's going to be conditions that attach to shelter, not just criminal behavior, but things far beyond that.
Have there been any attempts to amend the New York Constitution to remove the right to shelter?
No, they haven't gone that far, but certainly Giuliani, in tandem with Pataki, very cleverly rewrote some state regulations that oversee. And this is what Bloomberg is using now to have this sort of stepped-up active deterrence at the front end of the shelter system. You know, they're not building the housing, so they're trying to screw the door shut even tighter.
We hear that people come to New York from other states to take advantage of the right to shelter here. Do we know if that actually happens?
Well, the figure that they throw out is, I don't know, somewhere north of 20%. But when you speak to those people, many times they are actually people that were raised in New York but have temporarily relocated trying to get their act together, get some housing from families and then return here. But, you know, it's great that Ian included that great quote from Mayor Koch about people taking their limousines, their helicopters to their limousines to the, I guess, Bellevue Men's Shelter would be his stop.
No, it's that was so Bloomberg said that.
Yeah, he was attacking the coalition, saying that, you know, anybody could take their private limo to the front door of the shelter system, as though that had anything to do with the desperation that people in the shelter system are facing.
Well, Ian, you've described the Coalition for the Homeless as an organization that has disturbed and enraged the mayors of the nation's richest city regularly since it was founded in 1981, not long after the Callahan versus Kerry decision. So, Mary, are you proud of that? Is that something you're proud of? Well, making all those mayors angry?
I think there are some things that are worth getting angry about. And 22,000 children sleeping tonight in a shelter is at the top of my list. You know, the coalition is well known for its advocacy, but we also help 3,500 people every day. We feed 1,000 people every night on the streets. We provide job training, permanent housing. But that the big fight, the good fight, goes on, and we're in business to go out of business. We want to end this problem and close our doors.
Now, it's my sense that the homeless population in New York has fluctuated over the years. Mm-hmm. Is it mostly because of the way mayors have dealt with the issue, or is it usually just a reflection of what's going on in the economy and housing in general?
If you were talking about over the years, I mean, there were, you know, lots of what were then called vagabonds in the city after the Civil War. You know, there were lots and lots of homeless people during the Depression. But if you look at the pictures,
and the Bowery was where everybody seemed to be expected to go.
Well, most of the shelters were on the lower, you know, on the east side, right over by the river. And then down at what's now the Governor's Island Ferry Terminal, and those were pretty big. I mean, there was one shelter there, I think, that had 3,000 beds in one room. It was like a Ripley's Believe It or Not, world's largest dormitory thing. And so, you know, that was the Depression. That was caused by whatever economic forces caused that. But then, when the Second World War came along, those numbers were all absorbed, and, you know, suddenly there was really no homeless problem, or a much smaller one. Through the 60s, that was the case. And then there were a lot of patient rights laws that came out in the 60s and 70s, and suddenly you had a lot of mental patients being released from hospitals. And coincidentally, the numbers of homeless people in the city went way up in the late 70s. So, you know, it's very, it relates to other problems that exist in the society. Right now, the problem is the rents are, as the guy said, they're too damn high.
Well, should we assume that a lot of the homeless are also people who would have been in mental illness facilities in a previous time?
I did not find that, no. And I don't think, I found many homeless people who were working, who had jobs. I think 28% of the adults and families in the city who are homeless are working, have a job. So I think that the reason the numbers are so high now isn't that there's some kind of, you know, surge in the number of mentally ill people. I think it's that the economy has just gotten really, really hard for low-income people in New York City.
Well, should we assume that it isn't just New York? I've seen serious homeless problems in San Francisco,
right,
in Los Angeles, especially along the beach there, in other major cities. Any destination city, I would assume, attracts people who are looking for work and who are in danger of becoming homeless.
Yeah, but keep in mind that any city you go to, the vast majority of homeless people that you'll meet are from that locality. So it's not as though they're magnets pulling people. But, you know, the difference, like go to San Francisco or to L.A., the street population is largely single adults, and you will see a higher proportion of people with psychiatric disorders, etc. But the families is what's driving the insanity here in New York.
Now, we've seen a lot of new construction in New York. There are more housing units than ever. In the past, wasn't there always some kind of agreement that a certain proportion of the new units would be allocated to homeless people? Is that not happening anymore?
Well, what we're seeing now is less and less of that, but you still have some of these sweetheart deals where a tiny fraction will be built off-site somewhere. I think what interests people about this issue is not just the human toll, but also it cuts to what is the city, what kind of city do you want to live in? Do you want to be passing these husks of buildings that are empty because people only live there two weeks out of the year because they're really from Hong Kong or some other place? Or do we want a vibrant city where a kid can get up and actually go to school in the morning and reach his or her full potential?
Aren't many of these homeless shelters in areas that make it hard for kids to go to the school? Is NIMBY a factor? There's a shelter near JFK, for example. I'm assuming that kids who are enrolled in a school in the Bronx or in Brooklyn find it rather hard to get to school every day.
Right. Well, this is as this problem has exploded, we're seeing more and more of this. There's a federal law that says that every effort has to be made to locate a sheltered family near the kid's school. But in practice, we see youngsters spending 2 or 3 hours twice a day on buses and subways just trying to get to school in the morning.
If you're accepted into a shelter, how long can you stay? Are there limits?
Well, there isn't a limit, but the reason the numbers are so out of control is that without the housing to graduate into, now we're at the point where families are on average spending over 400 days, nights in a shelter. It was just unheard of in previous administrations.
And are there any requirements of being able to stay in a shelter? The homeless woman named Christine that we talked about earlier told you about having to attend classes. Why
Right.
would that be required?
Well, there are a number of requirements. You have to talk to, I think everybody that's in the shelter has a counselor, I think, is assigned a counselor. Anyway, I met people who were assigned counselors who would go to these meetings and said they were absolutely useless meetings, but they were mandatory. There are rules that you have to abide by in the shelter that you have to check in every 48 hours. You have to sign something at a certain time, like right before curfew. And if you miss that, then you're out of the shelter and you got to go back to PATH and you've got to go through all that bureaucracy again to get another shelter. I talked to a woman at PATH who had who took medication for depression and had slept through that meeting or that deadline where she had to sign in, and she was back at PATH trying to get another shelter assignment. So
you spoke to another woman at the Saratoga Family Inn, a shelter near JFK Airport. She said she gets a statement each month that shows how much it costs to house her and her two kids, $3,444 a month. That's kind of high, isn't it? She suggested it might have been better if they gave her $900 a month instead and she could just find an apartment. So does it cost more to provide shelter for families than it would cost to provide rent subsidies?
Well, this is one of the mysteries of the system, but it is. I think the average cost is over $3,000 a family a month.
Right.
So,
Well, that's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money, and it's also wasted money. You know, the Department of Homeless Services annual budget now is approaching $1 billion. And so we've been working, even before he was elected, with de Blasio's staff trying to implement the plan to, you know, get back to providing rent subsidies.
Well, he ran on a platform of providing more affordable housing and raising taxes on the wealthiest New Yorkers to fund Head Start and other programs. But it's also been reported, Ian, that he received campaign contributions from slum landlords who profit from running shelters of poor quality.
Well, when we mentioned that, you know, I mentioned that in the article. His staff is very emphatic that he is not swayed by those contributions. And in fact, one of the worst landlords gave a contribution which he returned. So, I mean, he says he's not under the influence of those landlords, and we have to, I think, hope that that's the case. But, you know, housing in the city is just each place is very specific. Each situation of trying to find a place to stay is very specific, and there are a wide range of people that are involved in it, obviously. So, you know, we have to hope that he can improve the situation.
Now, we have very little time, but Mary, I've been hearing for a long time about people who say that the poor need to take responsibility and that relying on welfare programs breeds reliance and laziness. How do you respond to those claims?
Well, if you want people to reach their full potential, give them some place where they can situate themselves, clean themselves up, you know, get to school. All of that points back to home. Home is the place where we are able to renew ourselves every night and go out the next day. And without that, it's very, very hard to demand that people step up. So for the coalition, this is the cornerstone of getting away from welfare dependency.
And during the course of each year, more than 111,000 different homeless New Yorkers, including more than 40,000 children, sleep in municipal shelters. Some of those kids have been finding it rather hard to get well-paying jobs. I mean, when we talk about well-paying jobs, well, we're talking about a lot of kids as well. My great thanks to Mary Bresnahan, President and CEO of the Coalition for the Homeless, and Ian Fraser, whose article, Hidden City, appeared in the October 28th issue of The New Yorker. It was an eye-opening article. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
On tomorrow's show, David Crystal explains why spelling in English is so much more difficult than in other languages and how we can tell when a word's being used as a noun or a verb. And then, with the new year on the horizon, we'll get tips on how to clean out closets, clear up clutter, and get your home organized for 2014. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls, and we had help today from Casey Dalrymple and contributing producer Barbara Kahn. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.